Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and this is just a quick recording we did this morning with Ukrainian MP Lesia Vasilenko, who has travelled back to Kyiv from the European the PACE meeting, the Permanent Assembly of the Council of Europe meetings, and a diplomatic mission she took part in to the UK. We discussed the events since we've last spoken and what the situation was like, and there was a relative normalcy in the morning in Kyiv, but I suppose overwhelmingly the sense is pretty grim, on the basis that, you know, the arguments obviously are demands for support, and people now, as we have a tendency to, we're the fatigue of almost reporting on war, where it starts to slip down the pages and atrocities become, instead of front page news, become, you know, page 5 or 6 on a newspaper. All of these things are starting to come to pass already, only a month into this brutal conflict. There are a list of organizations that I know Teresa Buczkowska recommended people who want to support. So those links are in the bio of this and in the last report we did. They're good organizations helping people who are finding it difficult to either get out of conflict areas, or when they do get to conflict areas, you know, getting processed and getting security as opposed to being detained. These are important organizations outside of just, you know, the Red Cross and the bigger NGOs. Do click on them. Seems really inappropriate to say this, but I do need to say, the Easter bank holiday weekend, there is a Tortoise Shack live show in the Sugar Club. So if you're around on that weekend and you've nothing to do, just go to eventbrite.ie, check for the Tortoise Shack, get your tickets, and we'll see lots of you there. But anyway, look, I'll let you listen now to my conversation from this morning with Ukrainian MP Lesia Vasilenko. Thanks very much, and do chip in that few quid to those organizations. They're doing important work. I'm delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by Ukrainian MP Lesia Vasilenko, who listeners will have heard many a time on the show. She has traveled back to Kyiv. Lesia, first of all, how are you? And thank you for talking to us again.
Oh, good morning. And thank you for having me again. It's an honor, really, to be able to talk to you. I'm fine. I'm back in Kyiv, so I'm very happy. Emotionally, I'm very, very happy to be here.
I know you had the last time we spoke, since the last time we spoke, I've seen pictures of you in the European Parliament. I've seen pictures of you in 10 Downing Street. And then I've seen pictures of you on the Polish-Ukrainian border. Can I ask you first, before we talk about events right now in Kyiv, what was your experience of the border situation? Because we have now currently a country of 40 million people, where 10 million people have been displaced. And that's, you know, the majority of them internally. But we've also seen, you know, 3 million of those have gone to either neighboring countries or countries like Ireland itself, which has taken in over 10,000 people already. What was your experience of the border, and how did it seem to you?
Well, the border crossing into Ukraine was really empty. I passed it in like 2 minutes. Actually, the border crossing on which I was, I don't know what was the reason, but there weren't that many cars either. But I guess it's a kind of, with borders, it's a kind of like a touch and go situation. At one point, there might be no cars whatsoever. At another point, there might be a queue forming in just under like 10 minutes of 10 kilometers and dozens of cars. But people, yes, just to give the general idea, people are still being evacuated and leaving war zones. And essentially, I would say that as things stand right now, I would encourage all civilians, mainly children and women, to leave. Because at the end of the day, if you're not holding the guns and if you're not doing your bit on the defensive, on the military work, then you're a liability. I'm sorry to say it in those words, but you are a military liability if you are a civilian who needs protecting. Because the Ukrainian army, we will never shoot civilians. We will never use buildings which house civilians as targets or as defense units. Every civilian that stays in a town that has become a combat zone is actually posing great difficulties and challenges for the defense of those cities and towns.
Yeah, I know we're talking about that in that way, but the corridors that we need to transfer people, to allow people to move, are, you know, we've seen huge problems like the in Mariupol, which is, you know, like has been absolutely decimated. The city has been decimated, but we've seen that, you know, the humanitarian corridors that you called for three and a half weeks ago now at this stage have been, you know, at best ropey, at best is ropey, is fair to say. Are people able to move safely towards more areas that are currently either not active in war zones or to cross borders?
You know, you raise a very painful topic of green corridors, or they're not green, they are red with the blood of people who are trying to leave. It's the same situation is all over the place. Towns like Mariupol, Bucha, Irpin, Hostomel, all of them have civilians who are desperately trying to leave and to get to safety, but they are prohibited by the Russians, who essentially say that, okay, we will give you a humanitarian corridor to get out of those towns, but as soon as the people start moving, they start shooting them. And, you know, just a couple of days ago, the devastation of the Mariupol humanitarian evacuation was just completely heartbreaking. And I can't even find the words for it, because as children and their mothers were walking out, they were shot in the back by Russian soldiers from AK guns, from shotguns, and just for no reason at all. I mean, these are children. They are walking away from you. Why do you shoot them? And the casualties that are being reported from the Zaporizhia Children's Hospital, they're just, you know, like, how do those people live with that afterwards? I mean, there was a family which was admitted. There was a mother who lost three of her limbs, two arms and one leg, because she was covering her children with her own body. And one of her children also has a missing limb, a leg. And the other has just very bad gunshot wounds. And situations like that, they have become the norm across Ukraine, where we see mothers just covering their babies, their newborn babies, their kids with their own bodies just to give them the chance to survive. And yes, it says a lot about motherhood and what mothers are capable of doing for their children, but it also says a lot about the brutality and the sheer barbaric actions of the Russian army.
And I think we've seen it's already documented. I know Human Rights Watch have been documenting a lot of they're making a list of war crimes in effect of some of these situations. And we've seen, I know you reported yesterday on a case of the, and I'm going to say the weaponization of rape as a thing of war as well. And I don't, you know, I'm conscious of this being very, very grim, and it is really, really dark. But I mean, you we started this by you saying that your mood was feeling better because you'd returned to Kyiv. Yet we know that, you know, the messages from the Kremlin, like the use of, say, a hypersonic missile, is purely a message to say, you know, your missile defense units, you can't stop these missiles. We've seen, you know, this escalation, and we continue to see your president has done I suppose, what many people would call a barnstorming tour of the world via Zoom in terms of challenging individual governments to do more. And, you know, he's continued to do that. But I don't think I get the impression. And again, I know your diplomatic mission to Downing Street seemed to be very successful in terms of pledges of artillery and military equipment and support. However, it does feel that that is setting up for a prolonged war now. There's no, because last time we spoke, we talked about the potential of this off ramp, and that discussion seems to have just gone away at the moment. Is that a fair assessment?
In all honesty, if we keep getting more weapons, be it artillery, be it anti-air raid weapons, this prolongs the time that Ukraine can keep control over its cities. But it's the kind of weapons we are getting is still not what we are asking for. We need more sophisticated and more robust anti-air raid systems, such as the S-200s and S-300s. We are still not getting those. These are on-ground air anti-airstrike systems, which for some reason we still haven't had the chance to negotiate over. And essentially, if that doesn't happen, then we need more presence here on the ground. I hear loud and clear that NATO is not going to go into this war. Fine. It's okay. It's a position. But there are organizations which are older than NATO, for example, the United Nations. And the UN members, of which, and the Ukraine is also a member of the UN, of course. So the UN members have an obligation to act collectively for the defense and security of the global community if one member is attacked by another member. Exactly the case was Ukraine and Russia. So we don't see much action there either. We see a lot of, excuses saying that, well, the Security Council can't do anything because it's paralyzed by the veto power of China and Russia. And what I say to that is that open the charter of the UN, open the rule books, and start reading. Because there were precedents in history, and the rules provided that when the Security Council is paralyzed in such a way by veto power of one of the members, then the General Assembly starts acting. And the General Assembly can do a much, much better job and issue a much stronger resolution, whereby calling on the international community to provide a peace corps, or call it a humanitarian task force on Ukraine. But we need boots on the ground, at least to guarantee the safety and security of safe passage for the civilians trying to flee the war zones and the theaters of war that have been formed around Ukrainian towns. And when I see and experience the whole world just standing by, sort of, it's as if a lot of the countries, the leadership of the countries, that would be the correct way to put it. It's as if a lot of the leadership of a lot of the countries in the Western world are standing by, looking on the situation in Ukraine and Russia as if it were a game, and sort of making bets like, ooh, if we give them this kind of weapon, how long will they last? And maybe if we help them out here a little bit, maybe that will strengthen Ukraine a little bit more. But it's in any case, it's absolutely irresponsible and completely unfair that the whole world is watching by as we struggle against the second largest army in the world, and as the whole world is still deliberating whether to give us or not some weapons, and when the whole world is, averting their eyes and making up excuses why they can't be here on the ground helping us. Like the situation with Russia, with Russia's aggression, it's not just about Ukraine and Russia. It's much bigger than that. It's about an act of aggression being committed and going unpunished And if acts of aggression or any other crimes go unpunished, that gives incentive to the perpetrator to do more and to act even more aggressively and to grab even more territories. But most importantly, it also gives a push and an inspiration to other totalitarian leaders across the world to also start up on the aggression. And if the leaders of the free world, as they like to call them today, don't act firmly and robustly in Ukraine on the ground, we will be seeing a lot more of these aggression hotspots around the world. But I think this is something that the free world will not like very much and will not be able to handle.
I think, look, you've just given a really good account of some of the inaction from the leaders. I particularly think, you know, I read another piece yesterday in a US report saying that the risk of the risk of them taking action and countering that against the damage that can be done, and it effectively what it was saying was almost the there's very limited economic cost currently to the US, therefore, you know, the trade-off of doing more is actually worse for them. So I just thought, yeah, it is very callous, but it was a really, really, really shitty thing to when you think about it in those economic terms. Can I ask though, in terms of the actual situation in your beloved city at the moment, there's talk of it being surrounded still, landmines been left on roads, but no real further escalation of the conflict. How does it seem to you, and what's the mood there in the city?
I had the luxury yesterday of actually walking around in the streets of Kyiv a little bit. So some neighborhoods which were very, very busy and were almost you wouldn't go there if you live in Kyiv. For example, the main street Khreshchatyk, it's absolutely empty. You can drive as fast as you can, well, at least until the next checkpoint. There's just this emptiness, but also this sense of freedom there. And then some other streets, that the emptiness is actually very scary, because you understand that people used to it's just like normal Kyivite people used to walk around here, that they used to be like bustling and very lively and nice. And you understand that now they are absolutely empty, and there's maybe like one car which passes by in the whole hour. So that is a little bit disturbing. But then there are streets, for example, in the area where I would normally live and where I still live, hopefully. that area is actually quite nice. There's a lot of people, you know, there's a park, so people go out in the park. There's women and children who are just, you know, going for walks, going to the normal stuff. You know, I even went into a cafe and had a coffee and a croissant yesterday. And that was amazing. And this mom sat next to me with her, I think like 5 or 6 year old boy. And they were just like enjoying the weather, the sunlight, enjoying the hot chocolate. And it's just heartwarming to see that the city is coming back bit by bit, not completely till normal, but still, people are living their lives. Some of these lives got changed. So, for example, the restaurants where I would normally go to, like to have dinner or for brunch on Sunday, they are now working, but not working as restaurants in the traditional sense. But all the team, all the staff, all the cooks, the chefs, they are working 24/7, preparing food in these restaurant kitchens and packing it up and sending to the territorial defense units of Kyiv and to the military, which is a really nice gesture, I think. And this is also a type of volunteering, and it's these restaurants doing their bit, not opening up for commerce, but doing their bit to caring for the Ukrainian army.
The last thing, I suppose, is I've seen reports, and I've not seen reports, I've spoken to people who are receiving weapons training, civilians who have, you know, joined the defense of your country, of Ukraine, and they're receiving weapons training, and they're going to putting themselves in the into these situations to in the defense of their country. But we also know that you, like the bombardment of Lviv, the base outside of Lviv was targeted at a training facility in effect for training soldiers and members of, you know, the international people who have come to fight as well. Has that continued now that there still continues to be a militarization of the civilian population of the people who are willing to stay and fight? Is that still continuing?
Yes, that is continuing. So a lot of civilians have already either joined volunteer efforts, humanitarian efforts, or the territorial defense battalions. But again, we go back, you know, to the start. So the civilians who have not done the same or who have just been doing volunteer work and assistance to the army in a piecemeal approach, then I would strongly advise, and the military strongly advises, for them to actually leave towards the west of Ukraine, not to be involved in the fighting.
That message has been pretty clear, but I would say the last thing, I suppose, is, do you feel that when you say to avoid the fighting, do you feel the next escalation is inevitable? Because it hasn't stopped, it's been displaced, or do you think that maybe there is reports again of the Russian military struggling with their own supply lines to continue the bombardments?
The way that I see that the bombardments of the Russians have become less in general, they can see, like, there can seem to be more air raid sirens in Kyiv, but at the same time the bombardments in their intensity have become less, although they are hitting targets, they are hitting particular targets, which means that they are now using the more sophisticated of the missiles and the launchers, the way that we see it here. How many of those do they have? As far as our intelligence sources tell us, not so many. So they are using them sparingly, but again, they are using them very much on target. So we will see where that takes us. But anyway, the determination is there to keep holding on and to keep standing strong.
And it's so grim having to say that out loud, you know, talking about depending on the enemy and how much weapons they have. It's very grim. Is there more any talks now of there being, you know, I know there's been, again, your president has more or less told everybody he accepts that he's not even asking for NATO now, because he knows that he feels that he's been led astray by the West, in effect, by, you know, the NATO membership isn't on the table. But is there opportunities here that we talked about, you know, Ukraine accepting some form of Russian withdrawal, Ukraine becoming neutral, holding onto its army? But what about the territories now that Putin has declared autonomous? Like, are these things, is there room for negotiation here, or is this going to be a lot more protracted and more bloody, unfortunately?
See, the negotiations are going on as we speak. I'm actually reading up on these negotiations and what is happening. And to be honest, I am not sure that the people of Ukraine will be willing to support the concessions being made to Russia. Especially, it is going to be difficult to explain it to the Ukrainian army. So all the while that the president is in talks with Russia, and he's constantly in talks with Russia, the deal will also depend on the support from the people, because at the moment the president has almost 100% support, as does the army. As soon as there is a crack in that support, one way or the other, we're looking at a whole different situation. And where that is going to take us, I don't know, in all honesty. There may be very different combinations. I don't want to think of the worst. I think that we are good as we are right now. Yes, it is war. Yes, the losses are huge, civilian losses including. But at the end of the day, the nation stands united.
Alexia Vasilenko, thank you for taking the time to talk to us this morning. I hope you keep well and enjoy a little bit of sunshine on your face today, because it's the news is very grim. And I, again, please take care and mind yourself. Thanks for talking to us.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
As always, it's great to continue to get to talk to Alexia, and you know, obviously, as myself and Leslie have often joked that in the normal run of politics, we don't exactly see eye to eye in things, but in terms of this situation here, it's nothing but respect for someone who continues to advocate for her country and fight for her country in whatever means she is willing to do so. That courage is both inspirational and also a bit terrifying to me, because as I said previously on podcasts, that the idea that I was actually on the phone talking to her as she was driving out from Kyiv to bring her children to a safer area, to return, only to return back to with her own weapons. So, you know, it's really grim, and these are the decisions she's making. And I think one of the key messages you heard there is that there are people digging in, whether they feel support is coming or not. We'll leave it there. There is more coverage obviously ongoing. Thanks for the support, thanks for listening, and maybe, you know, let people know where to find us. Other than that, guys, have a great day. Talk to you soon. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.